Okay, so the recording has started. I'm going to let everybody in. Okay, they're all joining.
Good morning, everyone. I hope everyone has been able to successfully join us for our second Zoom frequently asked questions session being hosted by our CEO benefits team and our disability management division. This is our second collaborative effort to try to get you all as many answers to questions that we know that you have during these difficult times of COVID-19 leave administration. You may notice that in today's Zoom, one of our four presenters, Tracy Sewell, is helping us to cruise through our SS leave of absence process. She was supposed to be on a cruise this week, so rather than being on her actual cruise, she is virtually cruising through the uncharted waters of COVID-19 leave of absence. So hopefully we can all enjoy that view, and this will hopefully be a session that also helps us to find our way to some calmer seas as we process the leaves. So again, we appreciate everyone's time here today for being here. We appreciate your questions. We're doing everything we can between CEO benefits and our disability management division to try to get you answers to the questions that you need. As long as you continue to have questions, we're going to continue to try to host these Zoom sessions so that we can offer you as much support as we possibly can. To that point, starting today, we are recording these sessions so that we can post them for anyone who isn't able to be here today, or if you want to share the information with additional people within your department, it will be another easy resource tool for your team. Before we get started, we're going to go ahead and just lay a few ground rules, so hopefully this makes it go very smoothly. First, we want you to know that everyone other than the four of us who are moderating here today, which is Tracy Sewell, Ken Mizuno, Lorena Colmenares, and myself, are all able to speak. The rest of you are muted. If you do have questions, you can present your questions in real time during the presentation, either through the chat mechanism, or you can raise your hand, at which point you will be unmuted and you can ask your question to the group at that time. So Lorena, can you explain to the group how they can access both the chat and the hand raising functions if they are not familiar?
Yes, hi, good morning everyone. Hope everyone's doing well. In order for you to raise your hand, you'll have to click on the participant toolbar, and then on the bottom of the underneath it, it's going to say raise your hand and you can click on it. Also, just wanted to mention, if you're going to be sending a question via chat, make sure to send it to Katzen so she can go ahead and view it on her screen. Thank you.
Great. So with those ground rules set, we're going to use the same format as we used last time, which is that Tracy will read the questions that have been presented. Ken will provide the answers as we have interpreted the questions, and you should be able to see all of the questions and the answers on your screen as we go through them. Tracy, I turn it over to you.
All right, thank you, Catherine. All right, so we need the first question 28 to continue from the last set of questions that we had. The first question, we have an employee who has underlying health conditions and is able to telework right now. When this is over and people are able to go back to work, she mentioned she would like to continue to telework. For now, we can accommodate, but when things get back to normal, we will need the employee to come into the office. Can our agency require the employee to come into the office? Can the employee get a doctor's note for the accommodation?
So the answer is current telework status is due to the emergency shelter in place order associated with COVID-19 and is not an accommodation associated with the disability. When the order is lifted or loosened and the employees are asked to return to work, an employee who feels they are unable to do so at the time due to a disability would need to go through the usual interactive and leave processes. Are there any questions relating to that answer?
No questions in the chat right now.
All right, we will move on to 29, but if you still have a question, go ahead and put that in the chat. All right, 29, is there going to be any formal approval process required similar to the natural disaster attestation request form for employee to be approved for the department to apply and receive 2/3 of the pay provided under EPSL?
The answer is there is no formal approval process, but keep in mind that EPSL is an employer paid benefit. Please refer to the leave and pay guides to determine how much the employee is eligible for, depending on the reason for the leave. The benefit amounts will need to be calculated by the agency and applied appropriately. The employee also should file for an LOA and provide required documentation to support the leave if out for more than 3 work days or out intermittently. Is there any questions pertaining to that answer?
No questions in the chat yet.
Okay, number 30. Once the attestation time ends and staff begins to use vacation time, will we continue to use LOA time during that vacation time? Example, the employee uses attestation time through April 24th and beginning on April 27th begins to use vacation time. Is that going to be LOA time? We will return the employee when we return to the offices or when the employee begins to telecommute, whichever occurs first.
And the answer is, if we are interpreting this correctly, LOA processes should continue as usual, followed by return to work/telework. Please keep in mind that the leave and how they are paid on are 2 separate things. Is there any questions on that answer?
We don't have anything in the chat.
All right, so question 31, can EPSL be used intermittently for up to 80 hours?
And the answer is, it was previously reported that the hours could only be used for a 2-week period, but after further research, it was confirmed that the 80 hours can be applied both consecutively and intermittently for up to 80 hours.
I just want to add on that one, for those of you who were on the COVID task force call a few weeks ago, well, maybe 2 weeks ago, that was a question that I had responded to and said it was strictly for a 2-week period. But just know, I think it was Sheriff that asked that question originally. Just know that we have now determined that it does not have to specifically be in a 2-week period. It's kind of like how we do FMLA regularly. It's even though they get 12 weeks, it doesn't have to be in a 12-week period. It can be spread out if they're on an intermittent leave.
And we do have a question in the chat, and I think you just kind of touched on that, Tracy, but the question is, so if intermittently, and it can expand over the course of a few weeks?
Correct, yes.
Sorry, we have one more chat. The additional 10 weeks of EPSL is for childcare, correct?
No, okay. It's not EPSL. EPSL is only the 2-week period, the first 2 weeks, or the 80 hours. The 10 weeks, that's called emergency family and medical care extension. So we call it the FMLA extension, or emergency FMLA extension. That is the 10 weeks that is only available to those who are caring for children due to school or daycare closure. They're 2 separate things, EPSL and emergency FMLA leave expansion leave.
Okay, we have another question in the chat. Can an employee use 40 hours of natural disaster attestation as approved by CEO and then use 40 hours of EPSL? The pay leave guide states one or the other, but it is up to 80 hours. Can they use the 40 hours EPSL after using the natural disaster attestation form after April 20th, 2020?
Yes, so EPSL and natural disaster pay run concurrently. So if they're only eligible for 40 hours of natural disaster attestation pay or natural disaster pay, then the other 40 hours would be EPSL. because EPSL, the first 40 hours of EPSL was running concurrently with the 40 hours of natural disaster pay. Did I miss something on that question? I hope I got that.
You got a thank you, so I think we're good.
Okay. So keep asking questions. I'm going to move on to the next one. Question 32, what do we do if the leave paperwork is provided and the employee doesn't return them? By providing the forms and the information, have we done our due diligence in helping the employee? They have an employee, went out on March 17th through March 20th. They got an approved attestation form, but no leave paperwork, it looks like. Worked March 23rd through the 26th. Then they went out again March 30th through May 1st. With an approved attestation form, but no leave paperwork still. Should two separate leave forms be done since we returned for a few days?
And the answer is yes. And if paperwork is not returned, the employee is absent without approval. So please follow your agency's policy on how to handle employees who are absent without approval.
And we do have a leave code for that. So and you all probably know that because you're the leave experts. No questions?
No questions.
Thanks, Catherine. All right, question 33. This is a long one, so I'll try to cut it down. I have a scenario that I would like to get more guidance on to confirm how this employee will be compensated while out. I will outline the scenario. Okay, employee covered under the management res, out to care for minor child due to school closure. Employees works a regular 5-day, 40-hour week. First day out was April 10th. They're not supposed to return until the June 22nd. Employees requested and used natural disaster pay from April 10th to April 24th. Employee does not want to use any accruals while out. From what I understand, this employee's eligibility for EPSL ran concurrent with the natural disaster pay since it exceeded 40 hours, correct? Yes, that's correct. Oh, sorry. Sorry, Ken. I don't want to take your... I want to take your call. Okay, so beginning April 27th, per the FMLA expansion, this employee would be eligible to be paid by county payroll on BCHRP 2/3 of their regular gross pay up to 200 per day and can file for unemployment to supplement.
So the first answer to the first question is yes. The second answer is yes. But in addition, UIB unemployment insurance benefits will be paying an additional $600 per week under the CARES Act. This is in addition to the weekly benefit amount under the unemployment insurance benefits, which can be as much as $450 per month. EDD has an online calculator that can be helpful in determining estimated amounts the employee would be eligible for, and the link is on the page there for you to see.
And Ken, Catherine, just real quick, Ken, you used this calculator. Are there any gotchas or tips that you have? I think you said it didn't factor in the 600 per week, or did it?
No, it only factored in the straight UIB fee, but there was mention of the additional, sorry, my garbage man is coming by. It was a mention of $600 additional beginning, I believe it was March 26th through like July 25th, but the dates are on the website. And it just says that there is an additional amount of pay that will be going to those eligible for certain UIB benefits. The only challenges that I saw on it were probably they want to know how many quarters. There's four quarters that have to be completed, and you have to insert amounts in each of the quarters. If you follow their website, you can see which quarters they're going to be using, because someone who applies for a benefit today doesn't necessarily, we will not necessarily be using the quarter that we're currently in. It will revert back to a 12-month period of time based on the calendar that they use based on the date of the application of the unemployment insurance benefit. So it's pretty spelled out on the website. if you have any questions on that, we, you know, we can help you independently.
And we have a couple questions that have come in. So starting with 33, question number 33, it says, so will the health insurance be terminated if the leave is considered AWA?
Yes. And also they will also receive a COBRA offer.
Typically,
keep in mind when COBRA offer applies, all flex credit allowances are no longer applicable. So the employee would be faced with having to pay for the full cost of their benefits with no flex credit subsidies, and they would be required to pay monthly as opposed to biweekly. So the employees are encouraged to file their leave of absence.
Yeah, typically this is what gets them to get the paperwork in. It can be used. I mean, it's a good tool to use if you have an employee who's not being compliant with paperwork requests, right, Ken?
Right.
Okay, I have another question. If an employee goes on an LOA to take care of a minor due to COVID-19 school closure, the employee is eligible to receive compensation of the two-third pay with $200 a day cap. Can the employee coordinate unemployment benefits and the use of accruals for the one-third of the lost wages? How does the additional $300 come into play? And how will the coordination be on our end to not overpay the employee?
These are all good
questions. The answer would be, yeah, they're all good questions. The answer to the first one would be yes, they can integrate with UIB and their accruals. Can you read the second part of that question, though?
Yes. So the second question is, how does the additional $300 come into play?
The $300 per week, I'm assuming?
Yeah, I wonder if they're referring to the extra $600 for unemployment. I'm not sure.
They said it should be $600, not $300.
Ah, there we go.
There's a little typo there. Sorry.
So that amount should also be factored in. That's a UIB benefit, so it should be factored into the amount that they receive from UIB. And then you can integrate with any accruals. It's actually to their advantage because now they can integrate less accruals. They'll be getting more from UIB, and the accruals will be able to last them a little bit longer. So hopefully that will be to their benefit.
And then the last part of that question is, how will the coordination be on our end to not overpay the employee?
Well, you'll have to keep track of what you paid them, how you calculated the payments. The best way to remedy a overpayment is you'd have to get the UIB statement from the employee so you can calculate if there's any overpayment or underpayment and then adjust accordingly.
And we have one more question, which I think has been answered, but just to be sure, if the employee wanted to file for UIB and use their accruals, would you coordinate both of the one-third of lost wages? Would you coordinate both for the one-third loss of wages?
I'm not sure I understand that one.
Let me try again because I did a bad job reading it. If the employee wanted to file for UIB and use their accruals, would you coordinate both for the one-third of lost wages?
Yes.
And then one more that has just popped in. Will the employee have to fill out an insurance appeal request to get their insurance reinstated if the employee finally submits the required leave of absence documents?
It's possible that they may have to. We are applying some leniency right now with appeals, but the employee from the date that their first payment was due has 30 days to make their payment. That's what we call their grace period. If they don't make it within their grace period, we have been applying some leniency to up to 60 days. but we are reviewing all the facts independently on each case and making that determination once we receive the request.
And I just want to add real quick on that. I want people to understand, the agency reps, some, most do, but I just want all to understand that it's not us making these rules. It's the insurance companies. We have to ask for special, you know, we have to give a special request if we want to extend this time. So it's not us cutting it off and then, oh, we may be able to give you a few more days. I just wanted them to understand that it is something we have to work with our carriers on. And we're happy to do so in situations like this.
Right. There's just a contractual piece to it that's many of you aren't aware of. So we are just following the contracts and applying all the deadlines that they apply to, that they give us.
Yes. Yeah. Even the 30-day grace period or 31, I'm sorry. It's 31, right, Ken? I always get mixed up.
It's 30 days.
Oh, 30. Okay. Even the 30-day grace period is something that we have to work out when we contract with these carriers. Any more questions, Catherine?
No more questions.
Okay. So question 34. For those that self-quarantine due to being high risk with underlying health conditions and have marked the first box on their approved attestation form but do not have a doctor's note, would that be considered a personal leave?
The answer would be yes. If they later provide the doctor's note, an adjustment can be done to give them the natural disaster pay.
And the next question I'll just read because it goes along with it. If it's a personal leave and the employee ends up providing a doctor's note after the fact, do we switch it to a medical leave?
Yes, you would change that to a medical leave.
Okay. And I guess the next question kind of is similar too. The new attestation form has an asterisk regarding documentation from healthcare provider. For those that marked those same boxes on their previous forms, do they now have to get written documentation from their physician to support those forms? Or is there an option to be lenient for those periods, but from the latest form moving forward, it will be required?
So the answer is if they've already been approved, there is no need to request paperwork for retrospective periods. However, going forward, we want to ensure all proper paperwork is provided.
Okay. Question 37. If an employee lives with or is caring for a parent or a husband or other person who is in a high-risk category, can they use the COVID paid time? It is not clear if the situation is specially considered an isolation case.
So the answer is living with a high-risk family member is not an eligible reason, though the employee may file for a personal LOA, applying their accruals to cover pay, caring for a family member is eligible. If the employee's care is needed and a doctor attests to this, as typical with any all family medical leaves. A doctor's note certifying the condition will be needed to file for LOA, and they may be able to apply accruals and integrate with other state benefits.
All right, question 38. We have an employee who checked other and wrote necessity to assist elderly parents who fall into the vulnerable population due to age and underlying health conditions. In this case, can we approve or what documentation do we need?
So the answer is the distinction is living with versus caring for a family member and a medical note from the parent's doctor attesting to designating the employee is needed.
And Tracy, we have a question. Could they get EPSL and EFMLA going back to question 37, could they get EPSL and EFMLA, or would this be treated as a regular non-COVID leave?
If they're referring to question 37, if the doctor does state that the employee is needed to care for the family member, they would qualify for EPSL, but they would not qualify for the FMLA expansion. That's only, the FMLA expansion is only for people who are caring for minor children due to school closure or daycare closure. And then what was the second part?
I think you answered the question. You answered it. Oh, sorry, and it says, I guess this part two would be, would it be treated as a regular non-COVID leave if they didn't qualify for those things?
Yes, if they didn't qualify. So in this example, 37's answer, if they're just wanting to stay at home and because the person's high risk, but they're not, their care is not needed, yeah, it would just be a personal leave. Okay, so I'll move to question 39. If an employee already received the natural disaster pay after April 1st that exceeded $200 in any given day, hopefully it didn't exceed $200 in any given day, but okay. Oh, I see, yes, natural disaster pay. Yes, it could exceed the $200, you're right. And they are now switching over to receive benefit provisions under EPSL that restrict it. Since we are applying these county paid natural disaster pay, do we need to factor in the total natural disaster pay amount in the aggregate limit of 12,000? The aggregate limit is 10, I believe. Okay, or do we just begin applying the EPSL requirement and start tracking the aggregate limit of 10,000 for the 10-week period? That's not right. The 10,000 is for the 2-week period. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, go ahead with the answer, Ken. Sorry.
Okay, so the answer is, EPSL and natural disaster pay run concurrent after April 1st, so the employee has already exhausted their EPSL. It sounds like you also may be referring to the family expansion pay rather than EPSL in the latter part of your questions. FMLA expansion pay has a 2-week waiting period, which was already fulfilled, so the clock should now be running on the 10-week FMLA expansion pay.
Yes, and as we talked about earlier, that 10-week FMLA expansion pay is only for those who are staying at home with minor children due to school closure, day and daycare closure. And that is 2/3 pay. All right, so question 40, if there's no questions on that. With summer around the corner, some employees will choose to travel within the United States as permitted during their vacation. Will the county encourage or enforce self-quarantine when they return? If the county enforces this, employees will need to use vacation annual leave accruals during that quarantine, correct?
The answer is, at this time, we are not aware of any such requirements.
Okay, question 41. Can an employee who is not FMLA CFRA eligible apply for a leave of absence under ADA FEHA if a doctor's note determines that the employee has an underlying medical condition and or the health of the employee is compromised and subsequently cannot perform his or her duties? If teleworking is not available, is the reassignment the only option, and how long does the reassignment process take?
So the answer is yes. If teleworking is not available, reassignment is an option. The time frame will be fact specific. If neither reassignment or telework are available, leave of absence is an accommodation.
We good, Catherine?
Yes, we don't have any questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. All right, so our last question before we'll open it up to anybody else who has questions. Assuming that no previous leave of absence has been requested, if an employee requests a leave after April 21st and the leave duration is longer than a week, is it possible for the employee to use additional hours from previous pay periods through the natural disaster attestation forms? Does that mean that everyone requesting a leave of absence exceeding the recently 40 hours approved on April 21st would have to use sick, vacation, or other leave banks to be fully compensated?
So the answer is no. The employee would only be eligible for the natural disaster pay that applies to leaves from 4/19 forward. Leave accruals would be necessary after that to integrate with whatever other benefits the employee is eligible for.
Yeah, if you look on those natural disaster attestation forms, they all have time periods, at least the first two do. And it only applies for leave taken during those periods. It's this latest one that is kind of open. It's from April 19th, for any time taken April 19th through the end of the COVID emergency. So they can't use previous natural disaster attestation forms because those time periods are passed.
And Tracy, I have another question.
Okay.
In regards to EPSL, if an employee takes 2 weeks, sorry, it just jumped up on me there. If the employee takes 2 weeks at the two-third pay or $200 day max to care for an individual subject to quarantine, but then become sick themselves and are subject to quarantine, is the employee eligible to receive EPSL again for their full pay over a two-week period up to $511 a day, or is the first part of the question, and then can they receive the EPSL benefit for both cases or just one?
Okay, so the DOL, Department of Labor, was very clear on this. Employees can only receive one 80-hour allotment of EPSL, regardless of how many COVID-related incidents they have or reasons they have. So it would just be up to 80 hours, and then that's it. They would not get a second EPSL period.
Then there's another part to the question. The first part, I'll see if I can take it. In a work comp case related to COVID-19, where an employee is compensated using administrative leave until they test positive, does the three-day benefit waiting period for work comp run concurrently with administrative leave? So the three-day waiting period would, as far as workers' compensation goes, it would only become a claim on the day that an employee tests positive. And typically, the paid admin leave would be from the day the employee was sent home up to the point where they actually had the test results received. So that part would be paid admin, and then as of the day of the first positive test, that would begin the three-day waiting period for the industrial claim. The period prior to the positive test would not be covered under workers' compensation, because at that point the employee would not have anything to indicate that they were in fact COVID positive. Then part two of the question is also, how does the 7-day waiting period for SDI or UIB work for or in conjunction with the EPSL?
So because EPSL doesn't have a waiting period, as this question alludes, it can get kind of confusing, which is why I know some agencies have developed spreadsheets to kind of track all of this. There is that 7-day waiting period for SDI. And Ken, I'm not sure, does unemployment have that same waiting period?
No, they waived the waiting period.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. They did waive the waiting period. So no waiting period for EPSL or UIB. Now, if SDI is involved, there's still a 7-day waiting period, or did they waive that too?
I think they waived it for COVID-19 related cases.
That's what I'm remembering, that they did waive it. EDD waived it for both SDI and UIB and paid family leave. So,
it shouldn't really apply.
Right. You'll just need to work all the benefits, you know, integrate them all and make sure that the employee is just not receiving more off than on. Hope I answered that correctly. I mean, sufficiently.
Okay, I have a couple more questions here. If an employee went on an unpaid leave of absence effective March 11th, 2020, due to an underlying medical condition and has a doctor's note, that they need to be out due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and they also have been submitting attestation forms to be paid. Is there a way for us to switch them from unpaid to paid?
Ken, you want to take that one?
Well, yeah, what was the type of leave? I'm sorry.
They were on an unpaid leave of absence beginning March 11th due to an underlying medical condition. They have a doctor's note that they need to be out due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and they have been submitting the attestation forms to be paid. The question is then, can they go from unpaid to paid?
Yes, if they're eligible for the attestation pay or any of the natural disaster pay and or EPSL, they would convert them to a paid leave. We can't deny those benefits. It makes it a little tricky, however, if the period that they were unpaid is more than one biweekly pay period, because now it requires for benefits, if the employee does sustain any kind of health benefits, those have to be billed so those can be paid and there's no interruption in coverage. And then once they resume back to a paid leave, then those will be automatically deducted from their paycheck. So that's where it gets a little tricky. You may have to consult with your lead analyst to find out if the pay period is going to be affected. If it is, then an EPCN employee premium continuation notice goes out to the employee for that one singular pay period or multiple pay periods if that applies.
Just as a clarification, the person who submitted the question said they have been out since that time, but they have no benefits.
Even better. So there's less complications. It's more of a seamless process when they have no benefits, so that they can, there's nothing that has to be billed. There's nothing that's going to lapse. So it's more just changing it from a paid leave, from an unpaid leave, to a paid leave.
Okay.
Ken, I just wanted to follow up on that. Is when they submit the off-cycle check request for the pay that they should have received during those times, are they also able to request that the retro payments for benefits be on that same check rather than sending out an EPSN? Is that an option?
They won't have that option because the auditor controller won't take any direction from the individual agency payroll offices as far as benefits concerned. They feel that's our piece, and it should be.
Yeah.
However, in answer to your question, we could work it that way, that we can double up on the benefits. But we may run into a problem where there's not sufficient pay because it's now you're capturing two health deductions, although you are getting two flex credits. It just requires a little bit more manual intervention. But if we can catch it, then we can go ahead and intervene and ask for two flex credits and two health deductions to be deducted so we can avoid the EPCN altogether. The only problem is when the off-cycle checks are requested, many times we are not included in the email that goes directly to the auditor controller. So for the time being, I would recommend if you do request any off-cycle checks that you include the lead analyst in that distribution email so we can see if there's any way to capture any double flex credits or double health deductions on one check.
Thank you, Ken. Sorry. Yeah, I forgot about all that. I don't want to create extra work for anybody. So if it is easier to send out the EPCN.
There would be two ways. The other way is a little bit more tricky, but it is possible.
Okay.
So the question, just to kind of close this one out, is then the final inquiry is, would it just be then a payroll adjustment? Normally, they would just do a payroll adjustment on their timesheet and would not request an off-cycle check. Is that an acceptable methodology?
Doing that method usually keeps auditor controller out of the loop, and it also keeps benefits out of the loop. So we don't have any kind of knowledge that what you're doing, because typically you just make the entries directly into VCHRP. There's no intervention from us or auditor controller payroll. So doing that method works and it pays the employees, but it doesn't sustain their benefits. So if you do that, you should probably let us know so that we can intervene and we can let auditor controller know that there is a prior pay adjustment that's going to be processed within this check. We would like an additional flex credit to be added, an additional set of health deductions to be added as well. So it's just a matter of keeping us in the loop so that we can keep benefits running smoothly.
Okay. Thank you, Ken. And I think just to, if I can follow up on that piece, is that I think in particular, keep making sure that benefits is aware is probably of, it's always of high importance to employees, but particularly in this time where people may find themselves suddenly having an exposure and their insurance will be of utmost importance to them and their families, making sure that our benefits team is kept in the loop, I think is particularly important. Okay, so.
Yeah, anytime there's a payroll adjustment for a prior pay period, we should probably be copied on that email. That's the short answer.
Okay, so moving on to a different question. If leave as an accommodation is the only option, what type of leave is it assuming that LOA paperwork is required? Is it personal? And do we need to get the department supervisor to sign off on the personal leave?
Well, you would apply any of your own agency practices as far as who signs what and who approves your leaves. Those are discretionary practices that apply to your agency. If you could read that first part of the question, I think I captured the second part of it.
A little bit. It's a if leave as an accommodation is the only option, what type of leave is it? Assuming that they are assuming LOA paperwork is required. I think that's really the question. Is LOA paperwork required and would that leave be personal?
Most likely would be personal, although if you have a medical note, we could see if it does apply as a under ADA or FEHA. Most likely it would be personal.
And I think in follow-up to that part is that yes, paperwork would be needed as you would have in any other leave. So whatever your usual leave protocols would be, you know, that you should be guided by what your usual protocols are. Okay, another question. To fairness of the process for every employee and based on the FFCRA Act, can we change an employee's schedule from a 980 to a 540 to compensate fully the extra 10 weeks of EPSL applying the two-third pay with a $200 max amount per day?
Anytime we have a leave that is captured under any of the entitlements, whether it be FMLA, CFRA, PDL, you should not be changing an employee's schedule. Their schedule is supposed to stay the same. The only exceptions that we have seen are maybe where an employee you're just changing maybe a day off, but it's still, the pay period is still basically the same. But the answer is no, you should not be changing schedules.
Yeah, and it seems like the employee would be eligible for the same amount, whether it's 980 or 540, right?
Yeah, you would just have to spread out the integration over more days or less days, depending on the schedule they have. But the integration amount shouldn't change.
Okay.
It's just easier to do it on a 540 than it is on a 980, but unfortunately we don't have that option of changing schedules during a time where they're protected.
That makes sense.
Next question is, how quickly will this video be available and where can we locate it? So those are great questions for those of us who are the first time out on the SSLOA. We hope it'll be available pretty much when we hang up with you guys, but we may need to do a little bit of figuring it. But I think the plan is to post it to the same location as all on the HR website where we have all the other COVID resources. We will also have a link to the video. I think that's the plan. Do you agree with that, Tracy?
Yes, I agree. That is exactly where we'll put it.
Okay. So if for some reason we run into unexpected rough seas, we will let you all know right away, but we hope that it should be pretty quickly at the conclusion of this particular session. Okay, have another one. Based on the question about the 980 versus the 540, wouldn't they lose out on the two-third pay up to $200 a day for the day off?
I don't think they would, because as we stated earlier, we're looking at that EPSL now as an 80-hour period of pay. So even if it goes more than those 10 days, you're fine. It's 80 hours. So no, they wouldn't lose, right?
I agree.
I think she's trying to see if they change it to a 540, the employee would get 10 days of at the maximum 200 as opposed to 9 days. And I see that point. However, if we get into changing schedules on this employee and not on this employee, we may get into a sticky situation where it may look, I don't know, maybe some sort of favoritism. I think we, across the board, we need to follow the same protocol that we've always followed, and that's they get it for their scheduled days off.
Oh, right. I see what you're saying, Kim. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, this question says, I may have missed this, but after the 80 hours of ESPL, is if an employee is home, unable to telework due to the childcare issues, they're eligible for up to 10 additional weeks at two-thirds pay. If so, does the hours or 2 weeks run concurrently with the 10 weeks, or is it separate and now they can be out up to 12 weeks?
Okay, so I'll take this question. There's two separate things. There's the EPSL, that's a two-week period. There's the emergency family or FMLA extension or expansion. The FMLA expansion is just expanding FMLA for a new reason, and that's for people who have to stay home due to childcare issues. It's a 12-week period, but they're saying in this case, there's a two-week waiting period for that expansion, the FMLA expansion. It's during that 2 weeks that you can run the EPSL concurrently. So yes, the 80 hours runs concurrent, but not with 10 weeks. It's running concurrent with the 12 weeks of FMLA. The 10 weeks, so you really should have the 2 weeks of EPSL and the 10 weeks of EFMLA. And then together, that would be the 12 weeks, the full 12 weeks of FMLA that they're entitled to.
And I would encourage anyone who hasn't recently, as you guys continue to go through this, Tracy's put together some really amazing resource documents that are on the intranet site. There's one that I think visually is very clear on this EPSL and FMLA, sort of how things run concurrently. And you all should have received last week, was it last week or the beginning of this week? Sorry, the weeks run together here. Sean did send out then another flowchart also that's also posted on that site that talks about the pay components as you run through these different requirements. Although the flowchart sort of at a first glance might look complex, I think it's very user-friendly for those of you who sort of understand these applications. Those are great resources that are on the site that I think are getting clearer visually to point you through the process. So if you haven't reviewed those recently or relied on those, I think they're an excellent resource. Okay, so here is another question. In regards to employees with various workday hour schedules, 8, 9, 10, or 12, are you saying that we average the two-thirds pay out of their 80 hours rather than each day?
No, because the 200 max is still the 200 max per day. So no, we wouldn't average it out. No. I don't.
No, that's correct, Tracy.
Okay.
It's per day.
So here's another one on this 980 question. Again, back to the question on the 980. If they only get $200 for 9 days in a pay period for 12 weeks, wouldn't they lose out on $1,200?
That would be $200 for 10 weeks. Potentially, yes. But again, we cannot change work schedules.
Thank you, Katie, for the cruise picture. It's softening the blow for me.
And so, Ken and Tracy, can I ask on this particular piece, because I'm getting the sense from the group that this 980 issue is a particularly problematic one. Would it be fair to say that we could reconfirm this position one more time with Matt Smith, and if there's a change, we'll notify the group, but for right now, we believe this is the correct interpretation?
Yes.
I think that would be fair to say and a good idea.
Yes, I agree. So what Ken is saying is absolutely correct, how we normally operate, because we want to make sure, you know, under FMLA, you're not allowed to change their aspects of their job. So I know he's just trying to protect the county. But in this case, yes, we will go see if there's anything out there that allows us to maybe make an exception during this time. Thank you, Catherine. That's a good suggestion.
And there's appreciation for that, and that there's also folks who fall into the 410 category. And I think obviously, we understand that. And when we pose the question to Matt, we will make clear that we're talking about anyone who's working anything other than a 540, what would be the correct application as he sees it. And if there's something different to share, we will do that. But for the short term, we continue to believe that it's a per day interpretation.
Yes.
So we have 5 minutes left. So I don't know if we want to just sort of give it any other final questions that people want to try to send in, not necessarily in response directly to these questions. We'll give it a minute or two to see if there's anything that rolls in additionally.
I just wanted to kind of piggyback the last concern about the 410. Like, we may have to consider also, and this may be something that they won't do, but let's say an employee who works 60 hours a week and they only work 4 days a week, should we be changing their schedule to 5 days a week when it's already clear that they don't work full time? You know, so we're applying it to others. Why not this employee? So that's the sort of concerns that I have that we should also address to Matt. Stretching out schedules to fit the employee's best accumulation of benefits, that makes any sense.
It makes perfect sense, and that's a really great point.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't see any additional questions. So hopefully you all have found this to be helpful and assistive. As we mentioned at the start, we'll continue to reach out to you and host these forums as long as there's questions that the team feels are questions they'd like answers to and that there's issues you'd like support on. Again, we thank you all. We understand this is an incredibly difficult time. that you're not just doing this. A lot of you are homeschooling and taking care of people in your households who are vulnerable to COVID-19, and there's fiscal implications. There's lots of things you're juggling. We know it's been incredibly stressful. We appreciate everything that you do. And we're doing our very best to try to support you guys as much as we can. Understanding that for us too, this is a big, huge learning curve for us too. But we appreciate your time and your partnership, and we will continue to try to get you answers as quickly and as accurately as we possibly can.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.